He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. This week on Media Watch, Hayden Donnell takes a look at how it's boiled over badly on Britain's streets this past week and also online over the identity of Olympic boxers half a world away.
This week we saw one of the biggest scandals in Olympic history and nobody's talking about it.
Can we get a fact check on that no one is talking about it claim?
We look at the role of the news media and social media and all that.
You have massive furores about both, which in both cases can be about very, very little.
But first, claims of abuse in Parliament, inter-party insults, and even claims a councillor's car's been shot at. All that happened this past week after a Prime Minister from the past warned that political parties need to tone down race-based rhetoric and wind back legislation that he said is winding people up.
Act says all political parties should condemn pellets being fired at a new Plymouth councillor's car. Legislation passed last week to let councils get rid of their Māori wards. A new Plymouth District Council yesterday voted to retain its ward. Councillor Murray Chong abstained, saying he feared voting against after finding a bullet dent in his ute.
That was News Talk ZB's news at 2 p.m. last Wednesday with news of what appeared to be an escalation on that issue of Māori wards that certainly sounded serious. Just the day before, Councillor Chong had told a council chamber, "Don't shoot the messenger," before he tearfully told them he wouldn't be campaigning against a Māori ward next year because he now feared for his safety. And while that was really the business of local government in Taranaki, where Councillor Chong has long been a controversial figure, it was the leader of a party in the National Government Coalition who made this point on News Talk ZB's news bulletin.
ACT leader David Seymour says that's unacceptable.
You can have a different view on Māori wards, but it's never acceptable to intimidate someone who's voting on behalf of the public.
Now that comment on ZB's news was stripped from a selfie video posted to X, formerly Twitter, by David Seymour himself after he turned up to work and heard that news about Murray Chong. Now, there's nothing new about politicians going straight to social media with their reactions, and these days, for news organisations to then make news out of that without saying where the comment came from. But if it had been a comment made to a reporter, well, the reporter might have asked, "How do you know that gunshot was about the Māori wards issue?" And that was a question Ingrid Hipkiss put to Councillor Chong himself on RNZ's Morning Report the same day.
So what made you think it was perhaps related to the Māori ward issue?
I'm really the only councillor that is proactive in speaking up against it, and I'm also the only councillor that are getting threats like this.
On Morning Report, Murray Chong went on to detail a series of hair-raising threats made against him, his family, and even his dog.
Enough's enough, and I think this, and it's not necessarily about the Māori ward, all I'm doing is speaking up.
On News Talk ZB's drive show, New Plymouth Mayor Neil Holdham told Heather Duplessy-Allen that councillors there do get a lot of threats about a lot of things.
Rate increases, individual projects, you know, obviously there's the issue around Māori wards. There's a broad range of issues, and it used to be people used to write in emails and, you know, that expressed their views kind of what I'd say quite professionally and constructively. Now it's just becoming increasingly aggressive.
And New Plymouth's Mayor and Murray Chong aren't the only ones calling for less of that in our politics lately. One thing that reliably makes the news from a National Party annual general meeting is whatever the party's contemporary godfather, Sir John Key, has to say if he's in attendance. And he was at this year's one last weekend. And intriguingly, he chose to comment on politics and race relations. And on Monday, on News Talk ZB, he cited law changes that he said were winding people up.
You know, when you have your budget day and it's dominated by a race protest, or when you have your opening of Parliament, that's the case, that's one side. But then you've got the iwi leaders walking out of meetings with the Prime Minister on the other. And then I think things like the Treaty Principles Bill, that's really, you know, wound people up. I actually don't support that legislation for some pretty good reasons, I think. So there's just a lot of stuff.
And among that stuff was the removal of Section 7AA from the Oranga Tamariki Act, which was what prompted the walkout that Sir John referred to there of Ngāpuhi leaders from the Iwi Chairs Forum hui 2 days earlier. Te Runanga o Iwi Ngāpuhi Chair Mane Tahere subsequently told Whakaate Māori's Te Ao Māori News that establishment of Te Akawhai Ora, the Māori Health Authority, and the Seabed and Foreshore Judgment, as well as legislative changes to Māori wards on local councils, were also at issue.
Kia hiki tēnei kōrero i wāinga nui anō i a tātou anō a Ngāpui. E te nui o mātou mokopuna, koenei tētai hehia kia whakawhānui tia tēnei take me pēha tātou a Ngāpui anō, kia tātou anō ki te hiki tēnei take.
And last Monday, viewers of 3 News saw Mane Tahere refer back to Sir John Key's conference comments at Ngāpui's parliamentary protest that day.
This is Ngāpui loud and clear. If you don't stop, we'll stop you.
Well, it is the government's coalition partner, ACT, that's pushing the treaty principles bill that Sir John Key said he doesn't support. But ACT's leader David Seymour told Newstalk ZB, John Key was a prime minister in simpler times, and he accused others of raising the temperature on ACT, including journalists.
Well, I certainly object to some of the rhetoric that we've heard even just in recent weeks, particularly about my colleague Karen Schiller. I don't think it's ever acceptable to say that somebody, is not the right type of person for their race or vice versa. It's certainly not acceptable for some journalists to ask the question, maybe you deserve that because of your policies.
Now, no journalist has actually put such a question to ACT's Karen Chua, as far as we know, though reporters have asked her about the slurs that Karen Chua herself highlighted last week, as we'll hear in a minute. And the same day, on the Beehive Buzz segment on ZB's Wellington Morning Show, ZB political editor Jason Wall said this when he was asked, would the race relations temperature in our politics be coming down a wee bit, as Sir John Key had urged?
No. There's absolutely no chance that is going to be happening because of parties like Te Pāti Māori, who that is basically their entire ethos, is to stoke this race relations sort of fire.
Now, to stoke race relations fire was a pretty reductive assessment of Te Pāti Māori's entire kaupapa there. But while Jason Walls probably didn't mean that literally, he did say that Te Pāti Māori's strident comments have also put the media in the middle of it all.
Te Pāti Māori will say something outrageous and then we'll get criticised for not covering it in a way that we would if the ACT party or another party would say something, we would put them on the front page. But at the same time, when we do cover it, we get criticised for actually stoking these race relations fires. And I hate to do the sort of woe is me media, but there is no real winners here unless parties like Te Pāti Māori, tone it down a bit.
Well, startling or inflammatory comments by MPs is not usually something our media shy away from reporting, but it is a dilemma when Te Pāti Māori have referred to white supremacy or genocide to attack the government and galvanise their own supporters in the past, and then news media have been accused by ACT of either ignoring or excusing that if they don't report it, or accused of amplifying and even encouraging it if they do. Now, as we heard a moment ago, David Seymour cited criticism of his colleague Karen Chua when asked about Sir John Key urging us all to calm the farm on race issues. And one Te Pāti Māori MP did call her a puppet of her party in public, but otherwise there's no outrageous racial slurs that have been made that the media have reported. But last week it was obvious that Karen Chua was upset about what had been said to her in Parliament in an interview she gave to 3 News.
I've had enough. I asked for an apology. That's all I wanted, and I didn't get one. And that is so disrespectful.
They know who they are, and they have no excuses, Karen Chua told 3 News. But the media don't know who they are, and when they asked the Speaker if he'd had any complaints laid with him, he said there had been none. Now, over at TVNZ, they even asked the Prime Minister during the National Party conference if he was worried about the minister. And political reporter Benedict Collins then followed up with this on One News.
She's going to continue to be peppered with questions around the changes she's making to Oranga Tamariki, around the moves they're making with boot camps. This isn't going to go away.
And by that time, Karen Chua had been peppered by questions from Stuff's political correspondent Tova O'Brien in an interview which didn't end well. The children's minister abruptly ended our interview in a bit of a huff, said Tova O'Brien in a Stuff story on the 1st of August, accompanied by a video of the final 6 minutes of that chat, which ended this way.
Remind people what was found to be happening at Kōrawai Manaaki, a youth justice
I'm sorry,
facility,
Tova, but the time that I said I could be here is actually over, and I actually have another meeting that I have to get to.
Can I play you a clip from... The minister's walking off. That appears to be the end of our interview.
Oh, that was loads of fun.
I can hear her saying that was loads of fun in the background.
Well, clearly that was not fun for Karen Chua, though the minister at that point was calm and not, obviously, in a huff. But in her story for Stuff, Tova O'Brien added this.
We didn't get through all our questions, and the minister took great issue with a lot of the ones we did manage to ask, labelling some revolting. You be the judge. Listen to the full interview.
We did, but it took a while. On the Tova podcast, that full interview clocked in at just over 30 minutes, and it started well enough. But when Tova O'Brien turned to the welfare of children, which is Karen Chua's ministerial responsibility, the interview veered off course about 15 minutes in, when questions about the effect of cuts to welfare providers and Oranga Tamariki and the possibility of harm to young people in the so-called boot camps came up. And about 20 minutes in, there were questions about accountability that caused more friction.
Yeah, well, and we need to make sure that we get that right. So short of
I'm actually running out of time, and so I've got 2 minutes.
Okay,
so,
short of a guarantee, if it happens, if a kid is, heaven forbid, abused in a boot camp, will you shut the program down? Can you give that commitment at least?
I will make sure that whoever hurts or harms a young person is held accountable.
And having promised a hustle because time was tight, it got more uptight as the questions kept coming.
But some of the things that you're suggesting, I would say no wonder victims from those reports are getting re-traumatised.
No, I think it's
because
really,
you're putting those thoughts in their head.
Now, after that walk away, Tova O'Brien carried on and played two clips from abuse survivors that she said she wanted Karen Chua to respond to, including this one from survivor and advocate Ken Clearwater.
She got a wee bit emotional and she told me this: I'm not happy about some of the decisions I have to make.
We wanted to ask the minister what decisions she wasn't happy about having to make, because there are a bunch of policies which seem counter to the Royal Commission into abuse.
Why wait until 30 minutes had gone by and after the minister had been perfectly clear that time was nearly up? Well, Tova O'Brien then told her listeners this.
Minister Chua refused to do another interview and also chose to buck the parliamentary convention of what we call walking across the bridge or the tiles. It's the opportunity that us press gallery reporters have to ask questions of ministers and MPs as they make their way into the parliament for question time.
But it's not usual at all for media to get anything like that long with a minister. And it doesn't seem reasonable to empty chair one who's just sat in your chair for almost half an hour, and also stayed beyond the time that she said she could spare. Now, it's true our minister certainly should expect confronting questions, and Karen Chua was defensive in the face of persistent but relevant questioning from Tova O'Brien. There was, however, no sympathy elsewhere at Stuff. In last weekend's Sunday Star Times, under the headline, "Karen, Put Your Big Girl Pants On," National Affairs editor Andrea Vance addressed the minister personally.
You and your party are responsible for some of the most contentious and divisive policies of the past two decades. Get out there, defend them with argument and intellect, and expect that you are going to take flak from those who believe they are the target of your ideas. There are genuine victims in politics, but they aren't in the ACT Party.
ACT is the party of crybabies and reaping what it sowed, said Andrea Vance, who also had this message in the Sunday Star Times for other attention-seeking political parties.
Supporters and the media buy into the drama and excitement and social media engagement it generates.
And in the end, that drama and engagement matters as much to the commercial media companies as it does to political parties, especially with social media now disrupting the formula for both. Now, this week, RNZ's daily podcast The Detail took a fascinating look at the tensions in Parliament between the ACT Party and Te Pāti Māori, and the claims and counterclaims about the treatment of Children's Minister and ACT MP Karen Chua. That was in last Wednesday's edition titled "The Speaker is Under Attack," and you'll find The Detail available for free at rnz.co.nz or on every major podcast platform. Now, last Wednesday, the New Zealand Herald copped a backlash too for publishing a front and back page wraparound ad which urged its readers to sign a petition to return the seabed and foreshore to public ownership. That ad, which also raised the prospect of closed beaches if that doesn't happen, was placed by the One Law for All lobby group Hobson's Pledge, and a full-page version also appeared in NZME's other North Island daily papers. Now, there's nothing new about advocacy advertising in our papers, and it doesn't, or shouldn't, influence the editorial content of them. Indeed, inside that same edition of The Herald, they reported that Starship Children's Hospital leaders had said that the removal of Treaty of Waitangi provisions from child protection laws would actually make their job more difficult. And there was also an article by Green co-leader Chloe Swarbrick urging the whole country to own our past and do better when making new laws. But all of that was obscured, quite literally, by the advert which turned the country's biggest selling daily paper into a political billboard. 2 days after the Hobson's Pledge wraparound advert, the Māori Journalists Association Kawea Te Rongo issued a statement expressing profound shock and dismay. They said the assertion that the foreshore and seabed must be restored to public ownership drives division and perpetuates racist rhetoric, as well as what they say is a false narrative that the foreshore and seabed is owned by Māori. The Herald has given a platform to sway public opinion against Māori interests, they said, and co-chair Marnie Dunlop compared it to the Kiwi versus Iwi political messaging from the early 2000s. Kawea Te Rongo also said they were concerned about the impact on staff at the Herald, Māori and non-Māori alike. On Thursday night, RNZ reported that the Advertising Standards Authority had received multiple complaints about the ad. But in a statement to RNZ, NZME said the content was clearly labelled as a paid advertisement, and NZME's commercial team are also quite separate, they pointed out. Publishing an advertisement is in no way NZME's endorsement of the message, products or services in those ads. Now, of course, almost all those other ads are not political or seeking to harvest support for a controversial cause, and NZME has in the past placed controversial advocacy ads backing causes and even foreign countries on the pages of its papers. And you only have to go back less than a year for the last time that The Herald gave up its entire front and back page for an advert that was part of a political campaign.
The newspaper arrived, says the New Zealand Herald, Monday, September 4. It has a big picture of a very grumpy-looking Christopher Luxon. The script says advertisement, and then Christopher Luxon, out of touch, too much risk.
That was Andrew Dickens, a host on NZME's radio network News Talk ZB and on Gold, telling listeners in September last year how an anti-National Party ad on the front page of The Herald had startled him when it appeared on the first official day of the election campaign. That ad was placed by the Council of Trade Unions in order to boost Labour, who at the time had been targeted in other papers, in ads by the Taxpayers' Union, which portrayed Labour as Stalinist, Soviet-style economic authoritarians. Now, these kind of ads do carry a risk for the publishers, as Andrew Dickens explained to his ZB listeners last year.
This will probably backfire on The Herald, because, here we go, here's a text right now. I have cancelled my subscription to the New Zealand Herald because of the ad on the front cover.
So in the end then, publishers will weigh up the risk of offending some of their customers to the point that it might cost them a bit against the benefit of banking a cheque from cashed-up campaigners. Last Thursday, the Māori journalist group Kawea Te Rongo also urged NZME to take a more responsible approach in future to advertising and also to formally apologise to their Māori staff members, contributors, advertisers and audience for running that Hobson's Pledge ad. But there's been no sign of either yet from NZME, who, as we heard, have insisted it was just an ad and not an endorsement and that it was nothing to do with its journalism or its journalists. Carmen Parahi is one of New Zealand's most experienced Māori journalists and editors. From 2020 until earlier this year, she was at Stuff, leading its company-wide Potiaki strategy, which was all about improving the representation of Māori and coverage of Māori issues. She was named Editorial Executive of the Year at the Voyager Media Awards in 2021. So this week I asked her if she thought it was wrong of The Herald to run that ad.
To see that in our faces on Wednesday was a slap in the face, because it absolutely looked like something you would read from the late 90s and the early 2000s, which we called out in Tāmata Tono Stuff's apology to Māori. We had already identified how the news media had caused discrimination and had been anti-Māori through the CBN and foreshore debates in Tāmata Tono, the apology. And so to see what we saw this week was a slap in the face to good journalism and the good journalists in The Herald. And when you put out front page ads like what we saw on Wednesday, and then come out on Thursday and back yourselves and say it was an ad, we have freedom of expression and freedom of speech. No, you failed to uphold good principles. You failed your New Zealand Herald newsroom and journalists. You failed your Māori staff, because your Māori staff carry a cultural burden non-Māori staff do not understand. Someone needs to be held to account for the decision to publish that ad as a front page wrap around their newspaper. The public cannot discern the difference on a front page wrap compared to an ad inside the paper.
But it's labelled as a paid advertisement, and so was the election one in September last year?
Yeah, they are paid advertisements. But because it's a wrap, the front of the paper, the ad, looks like the title of the front page of the newspaper, then you have even more of a problem. Also, it's a political lobby group.
But there's nothing new about political lobby groups placing ads, and again, that Council of Trade Unions one is an example.
The problem is public perception. Māori and non-Māori have been incensed by that ad. I have seen multiple people on social media posting up their receipts to cancel their subs to the New Zealand Herald.
But inside that same edition of the paper, which was wrapped around with that Hobson's Pledge advertisement, there's a Chloe Swalbrick article, Green co-leader, saying we need to own our history, abide by principles of Te Tiriti.
It does not matter what they had inside the paper. The problem is they wrapped that newspaper, which could have had excellent journalism in it, a political ad, an anti-Māori ad, an ad that carries untruths. ASA, I'm going to be very interested to see how ASA deals with this ad.
But doesn't it go to show also, Carmen, that the two things can coexist? You have a commercial policy that allows you to take advocacy ads on the belief that they're not part of the editorial content of the paper, and still do the very good work such as that Whenua, Our Land, Our History series, which ran last month?
No one is saying that you can't. Advocacy advertising is fine, but you have to ask whether you put it on the front page wrap. We're used to seeing Harvey Norman, The Warehouse, and commercial ads, right? This is not just a Māori issue. There are many New Zealanders who were offended, and that is the perception of the public. And let's face it, newspapers are currently on life support, and they need as much money as they can. But I would caution all newspapers from wrapping your newspaper with political ads.
That was Carmen Parahi, formerly an editor at Stuff, who led its company-wide Poltiaki strategy. These days she is an independent media producer. And there she was talking to me about the New Zealand Herald's controversial decision to run a full-page, front and back-page wraparound ad for the lobby group Hobson's Pledge and its petition on foreshore and seabed legislation. Meanwhile, on the other side of the planet, pleas to tone down rhetoric on race and identity are falling on deaf ears, while also being echoed in the media here, with social media amplifying the aggression and leaving facts far behind, as Hayden Donnell now reports.
I think a woman's going to die at some point. That's what's going to happen. Someone is going to die.
Unfortunately, Jesse, that's what it's going to take.
That's Jesse Watters introducing the former college swimmer Riley Gaines on his Fox News show last week. They were talking about the Algerian boxer Imane Khelif, who this week won gold in the women's welterweight boxing. No one died in the making of her medal, but that exchange was just a tiny fraction of a generalised freakout from conservative pundits, particularly in the States, over Khelif's Olympic participation this week.
He's a man. He has the punching power of a man. And to put him in there with women is just not only unfair, but absolutely dangerous.
So this is disgusting, Laura. That's unethical and it's outright dangerous.
So they're going to hang a gold medal around this guy's neck for punching women in the face. How the hell is this country, is this world, going to stand for that?
I don't get enraged very easily, but this one did it for me. That young woman from Italy, she had practiced her entire life for this moment, for her to be able to go to the Olympics, and she got punched in the face by a guy. By the way, South Park predicted all of this, guys.
They usually do. Yeah.
And you know what? It's okay to beat women. That's what it comes down to.
This week, we saw one of the biggest scandals in Olympic history, and nobody's talking about it.
Can we get a fact check on that no one is talking about it claim? If you can't already tell, that mass meltdown was all over the fact that in these pundits' eyes, Khalif is a man, a guy, or in the words of Fox News' Jenny Pirow, a so-called person. Some of these commentators have claimed that she and another boxer caught up in the rancor, Taiwan's Lin Yuting, have XY chromosomes, elevated testosterone, or both. Others have gone further. The Boston Globe went right ahead and called Khalif transgender in an article headline. On Newstalk ZB, sports reporter Guy Hevelt also hinted at that possibility.
Because it's obviously something that's happening in society a lot more in terms of people changing their genders and that sort of thing. But in those sorts of sports, like boxing particularly, where it is so physical and that sort of thing, that is something where you can't take risks.
There may be more people changing their gender these days, but Khalif is not one of them. She and Yuting were assigned female at birth and have lived their whole lives as female. Moreover, in Algeria, changing gender is illegal. In the words of IOC spokesman Mark Adams,
these women were born as girls, they are registered as female, they have female passports, they have competed for the last 6 or 7 years in senior competition. They've won bouts and they've lost bouts as women.
The Boston Globe has since retracted and apologised for its headline. To be fair to Hevelt, it seems he only learned about this story shortly before going on air, but it's possible Newstalk could issue a wee clarification of its own. As for the other claims about hormones and chromosomes, they're also, to put it generously, pretty iffy. All the medical opinions being confidently bandied about stem from opaque, as yet unreleased tests from a Russian-led boxing organisation that's currently banned from Olympic participation due to its alleged corruption. That organisation, the IBA, has given conflicting information about what its tests actually show, and in the eyes of Adams, the whole process around them has been impossibly flawed.
I just don't think they have any credibility in the way that they've been carried out, why they've been carried about, for what purpose they've been carried out, what the test was for, why those two athletes were themselves targeted. There's all sorts of rumours why they were targeted in terms of who they might have beaten in previous rounds of the competition and what nationality those boxers were.
To their credit, many of our media outlets, both local and international, have tried to get some of these facts across. The New Zealand Herald has been in trouble for using AI to write its editorials lately, but its editorial on Khalif, published last Saturday, is a relatively enlightening take on a boxer it says has been unjustifiably turned into a talking point in an increasingly bitter debate about trans participation in sport. The same paper and its NZME stablemate Newstalk ZB published a useful explainer on the issue by Bonnie Jensen, while One News has run its own fact checks. Meanwhile, RNZ's The Panel and NZME's podcast The Front Page have both talked to Professor in Sociology of Sport and Gender, Holly Thorpe.
Gender is much more complex than just testosterone, right? So they're trying to move away from that. But we have a really long history in sport of assuming that if women are good at sport, they might be men masquerading as women.
But all these experts may as well have been bailing water out of a leaky boat. For every media explainer, there's 10,000 misleading posts on social media, and most particularly the platform formerly known as Twitter, X. It's there that Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters called Khalif's first-round defeat of Italian boxer Angela Carini a, quote, shocking example of why biological men should not compete in women's sports. He's been joined in those dubious sentiments by politicians like Republican vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance and Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. Meanwhile, Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling imputed some kind of malice to Khalif hitting someone in the hitting people competition, accusing the boxer of having the smirk of a male who's, quote, enjoying the distress of a woman he's just punched in the head. The misplaced jabs at Khalif aren't the only misinformation from X to have real-world consequences this month. In the UK, far-right anti-immigration protesters rioted after posters on X published a false name for the person who committed a stabbing attack on a children's yoga class in Southport, while also inaccurately claiming that person is Muslim. Those lies were spurred on by the likes of influencers Tommy Robinson, a convicted criminal, and Andrew Tate, who's facing charges of trafficking young women. On the News Agents podcast, journalist Lewis Goodall linked the boxing controversy and the street violence in England to the same source.
Instead of doing what most people would do when they read them, which is to say, gosh, this sounds really complicated, I think we should, and what normal political figures would have done, which is wait for to comment, wait for the facts to come out, and then give a sort of reasoned response in the aftermath. Instead, they jump on both of them, declare that this is some massive kind of problem and that this is an example of kind of basically the degradation of civilization itself and there needs to be action and so on. And in the process, spread falsehoods and misinformation which percolate down the online tree to ordinary people who are online. And before you know where you are, you have massive furores about both, which in both cases can be about very, very little.
That problem is so pernicious on X, partly because its owner not only tolerates prejudice and misinformation, he actively participates in them. Elon Musk, not deterred by the fact Khalif isn't a man, has reposted people calling for so-called men to be kept out of women's sports. On the Southport protests, he's said, civil war is inevitable. This is Goodall again.
So many of these strands do actually lead back to Twitter, now X, because it has become the kind of fulcrum for many of these views to become normalised, that even a few years ago, when it was under a different ownership model, it was difficult to see because these sorts of posts and these sorts of ideas were not allowed on a platform. Now they are being diffused down from the very, very top itself.
X, or Twitter, has never exactly been a bastion of enlightened debate, but under Musk's stewardship, it's become a place where abuse is rife and lies go virtually unchecked. It's turned into, in the eyes of The Guardian's Carol Cadwalader, a polarisation engine. You can see that engine in action on the timeline of the platform presenter Leah Panipa. She spent last Friday morning on X reposting people calling Khalif a man punching a woman. That afternoon, she invited former league player and boxing promoter Dean Lonergan onto her show to talk over the issue. Perhaps she thought he'd take her side. Instead, he, slightly inelegantly but strongly all the same, made the case for Khalif to stay in the competition.
She presents as a woman, has lived her entire life as a woman, but has obvious advantages thanks to her genetic makeup. Is that any different to Usain Bolt having genetic makeup that makes him a wonderful runner with all the fast twitch fibre and muscle mass that he got in his life? Is it really any different? Because it's been naturally gifted to him, just like this condition's been gifted to her.
Lonergan concluded by backing the IOC's handling of the issue.
This is someone who's competed and been beaten. I think it's a hard call to make, but I'd suggest the IOC's probably got it right. She should compete.
That strange noise might be the sound of an online bubble briefly being pierced. More of those moments would be welcome, but to get them, we all might have to log off.
Hayden Donnell there on two stories half a world away, fueled by social media outrage, which also fired up the news media. Last weekend on Media Watch, we looked at the revelation that the New Zealand Herald had used artificial intelligence tools to write some of its editorials. But readers were in the dark about that, and it turned out so were some of the paper's staff. And this past week, some of the media have been a bit dark about that too. But as we heard, it was all in line with the policy at the Herald's publisher NZME, where they say they do use AI, but with appropriate human oversight. Well, this week, an editorial meeting was held at the Herald for staff to discuss that. Now, obviously, this was an in-house affair, but in this week's Midweek Media Watch, last Wednesday, I discussed what we understood was discussed in that meeting. And while we were at it, some standout media moments from the Olympics in Paris, including presenters who gave it everything.
Vicky Bob! Vicky Bob!
While others held a bit back in reserve.
It's going to be the Jamaicans coming through. Ooh, it might be I don't know who's won that.
And then there were others who found innovative ways to impress upon us record-breaking speed.
Setting a world record 6.06 seconds, clambering up the 15-metre incline. Less time than it's taken for me to read this sentence.
If you missed it this week, Midweek Media Watch is on the Media Watch page at rnz.co.nz, our section of the RNZ app, or you'll find it in our podcast feed. And while it appears that the Herald's publisher NZME is sticking to its guns on that policy on AI, coincidentally this week, the ABC in Australia held a live stream public forum called Futurecast discussing AI policy out in the open, including how it should be used in journalism. But on the matter of disclosing the use of AI and maintaining public trust, the chief technology officer of Australia's biggest publisher, News Corp, Julian Delaney, told The Gathering this.
The risks are actually, once again, going back to a consumer, raising up questions for a consumer of trust. And that then, in a strange way, provides an incredible opportunity for a publisher to shine. And to shine with trusted content that is of value. If we go forward, then there might be a time where a news site is stamped no AI, and therefore they're the ones that people really are drawn to. Or there might be a news site that says completely done by AI. I don't know. The junction we're at now is still in exploratory stages.
Yep.
So we're still learning, and things will get clearer.
Now, elsewhere in the Asia-Pacific region, AI is already being used in journalism in ways that no one's even thought of yet here, and they're also dealing with the consequences of convincing but fake AI stuff that's undermining their news and media. And I found out much more about that at a recent East-West Centre International Media Conference held in the Philippines.
You can ask opinions of the chatbot to check whether your article can be misunderstood. That's one of my favourite prompts.
And that's effective?
Yeah. AI is perfectly suited for that.
First few words, I thought it was me. And then later on, when I realized it's also part of the deepfake technology where they splice your voice or get your words from your old videos, and then they just put it together to make it sound like you.
So this is possibly the most distressing possible way to find out just how easy and how effective for bad purposes this technology can be.
Yes. We would, as journalists, we would always report and talk about AI, but when it happens to you, when you become the victim, that's when you realize how serious it could be and that you're helpless. You don't know what to do at first.
Hear all about that next weekend here on Media Watch. Well, that's all from Media Watch for this weekend. Thanks for listening. Hayden will be back with Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday, and then we'll both be back again with Media Watch as usual next weekend. Follow Media Watch and listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast app to make sure you never miss an episode. Now, if you have any thoughts to share with us or ideas for us to follow up, do get in touch. You can email us, mediawatch@rnz.co.nz, or you'll also find us at MediaWatchNZ on X. And you can even write us an old-fashioned letter and send it to PO Box 123 Wellington. Well, that's all from us for now. Ka kite. Catch you again for Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday night.